essential question is, what is it about the prayer Kol Nidre? If you would translate it, people would be very disappointed as how we're starting Yom Kippur. Most people hear Kol Nidre, it's some kind of glorious entreaty to God to give us another year of life and success and happiness and the emotion that the outpouring of feelings in the room of seeing every old men with the talisim and the seriousness of the day, and you know, probably people are not as hungry as they usually might be when the Yontif is starting. When Shabbos and Yontif, you're supposed to not eat that whole afternoon, so everyone's in shul pretty full at that point, right? So what is it about Kol Nidre that makes it worthy to start this holiest of days? So it's just a quick paragraph about the absolution of vows, something we already did on the day before Rosh Hashanah, traditionally. So what is it that makes this an appropriate way to begin Yom Kippur? To start with, on the first page, is the source in Chazal. I mean, I gave you a Mishnah. I can give you 20 Gemaras on this. A Mishnah and two statements of the Rambam. The Mishnah says that the Torah only has absolution of vows between a man and his wife and a man and his daughter. But for one man to absolve a woman who's not one of those two or another man, there's nothing in the Torah that says that has anything to say about that. Right? In fact, the Mishnah says, Hetar Nedarim Parochin Ba'avir. The laws of Hataras Nedarim are flying in the air. Where did they come from? There's no verse. So the Gemara on this Mishnah cites about 10 different verses that give a hint to this. Give a hint, but nothing explicit. There's nothing explicit in the Torah that indicates that one man can absolve another man of a vow. And it says, look at the Rambam.
That's what
this year is about. V'chlal, hine ein raya al ze min ha-kosuv. There's no proof of this from the text of the Torah. Right? V'hem omrim, hetun adorim porchin ba'avir. You see that in the Mishnah there. And then the Rambam Perush HaMishnah, at the end of Maseches Nedarim, says the same thing, and it's quite obvious and clear. Right? Now, I'm going, since we're a little pressed with time, I'm going to answer this question right now. And I'm going to do so with a history lesson. The observance of Yom Kippur over the ages has varied profoundly in different Jewish communities. And how to observe the words of the Torah, V'imisem es nafshoseichem. You must afflict your souls. Just those two words are very nebulous. How do you afflict your soul? Should everybody here just be given their own... Everyone here has a different idea of how to afflict a soul. The Torah, in other places, is more specific about certain things. Eat something, don't eat something. The Torah never says don't eat on Yom Kippur. It just says afflict yourselves. So if you live in a system that has an oral tradition that tells you how to afflict yourself, it's not given to everybody's own personal opinion, but that there is one general focus of just two things. Don't eat, don't drink. Right? If you have an oral tradition, that's how you will observe Yom Kippur. By not eating and not drinking, as far as the Torah law is concerned. Then, the rabbinic law said a few additional things. Don't wear your regular shoes, don't engage in marital relations, don't put on oils and creams. Right, don't wash. Right,
but in the Torah it says.
In the Torah
it says don't eat.
Just
or drink.
No. So, but there's a difference between the first two that I just mentioned. That's an oral tradition of what the Torah meant by v'inisem es nafshoseichem. In other words, I'll give other examples of this. The Torah says on Sukkot, take a pre-Eitz Hadar, take a beautiful fruit. When the rabbis say we have a tradition that is an etrog. That's a Torah law, right? So it's a Torah law because we have a tradition. I'm going to try to prove that tradition. We have a tradition that Yom Kippur is observed by refraining from eating and drinking, and that's the Torah law. But everybody agrees that the other things we avoid on Yom Kippur is rabbinic, the rabbinic law. Okay? we might say, let's say, on we have a Torah law that the fruit we take on Sukkot is an etrog. The rabbinic law is that you take not one but three myrtle branches. All right, so if you only have one, you should still carry that. We don't make a bracha on such a lulav, but you should certainly carry just one myrtle branch because it's only rabbinic that we take three. How do I know? Because there's a dispute in the Mishnah. What is Rabbi Akiva says you only take one. All right. So once there's a dispute like that, it can no longer be a Torah law. It's only rabbinic things that we have such disputes. All right. So anyway, the point is that the Torah law is divined by the rabbis to say this is what the Torah meant by afflict yourself, and everyone does it the same way. Then there might be some other customs, because if you leave it to individuals to decide what affliction is, it's chaotic. Right? So there has to be something everyone's doing the same, that's eating and drinking. It's refraining from those two. And there is actually, I just want to tell you, a nafkamina lahalacha, a difference in as far as practice, is because when the Torah says eat something or don't eat something, there's always a measure of that. Remember what that's called?
Kazayas,
the size of an olive. Right? Eat matzah, kazayas. Eat marah, kazayas. Don't eat pork, kazayas. So when the Torah says don't eat something, that's shiras kazayas. The Torah never says don't eat on Yom Kippur. It says afflict yourself. So when the rabbis discuss, what is it that you have to avoid on Yom Kippur? So what do you think? More than the kazayas or less than the kazayas?
More than the kazayas.
Technically speaking, therefore, from what we just said, you're allowed to eat on Yom Kippur. Because eating is defined by halacha as an olive, and the kazayas. The shear of what you're not supposed to eat on Yom Kippur, what I tell people when they're very ill and they're on chemotherapy, but they want to fast. So it's okay, good. If you eat a certain amount within less than a certain amount of time, you're still fasting. Because everyone who does it, I ask them afterwards, so how did you do? I call them afterwards, and they say, you know, I didn't feel satisfied, but I got the nutrition that the doctor says I needed.
Right?
So, but you see it that it's as if though they're still fasting, because it's not fasting that we want you to do in Yom Kippur. It's affliction that we want you to do in Yom Kippur, and affliction will be observed even while eating a little bit. Obviously, those who are well enough don't go that. You can't do. We don't do that at the outset, right? But this is.
The rabbis came up with that shear. Don't eat less than this. Then who's the one who said don't eat? Period.
So you'll have more affliction if you don't eat at all, and if you're well, you know. What can I say? You know, if a perfectly well person says, you know, I'm having the mood for some white chocolate. I'm going to have something with a lot of fat in it. I'm going to prop myself up. That person is not in the spirit of Yom Kippur, but he didn't violate Yom Kippur because he didn't eat the shear. He didn't eat the measurement.
Right, but
it's not in the spirit of Yom Kippur to do that.
But we do.
You're allowing a little bit.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope, you know.
You just said that, like, there was no definition to begin with, and then they came up with a definition that...
Well, the highest ideal in Judaism is his human life, so look, if this person is really ill, don't just eat, just don't, you know...
If there was never anything, period, then who's the one who said, all right, you know what, if you're well enough, just don't eat.
The rabbis got together, and they asked people, they asked 1,000 people, you know, different stages. Obviously, you know, different people are satisfied with different amounts, and they came up to a certain amount. It's the size of a fresh date, which is considerably bigger than the size of an olive. But if you eat less than that, you haven't satisfied yourself, and therefore, that's what you can do under certain circumstances on Yom Kippur. We're veering too far off of the point I'm trying to make. Karaites, you know what they are? Karaites and the Dead Sea Scrolls sects, people who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, Kutim, Tzedukim, Baitusim, there were different groups of Jews over the ages. As far back as I'm going to show you from the Tanakh times, there were Jewish communities that did not have oral traditions. They just held from the written word of the Torah. That's what they called Karaites, Kara. They only held from what was Kara, what they could read in the text.
Over and above the
eyes. No oral traditions. So in the Karaites, there's still very few of them today. There was a Karaite center in the Old City in Yerushalayim. There's a small community in Staten Island. And there was they were persecuted by the Nazis also. But they're very few in number today. So the Karaites observe Yom Kippur in each in their own way, because they don't have an oral tradition of what Be'inisim es nafsho seichem means. So because they don't have this oral tradition, they just afflict themselves wherever they want. And so Karaites have written halachic works, halachic guides, how a Karaite should hold himself. And they do some outrageous things. You ever see the Shiites where they're reproducing that battle, right, between Muhammad's son and Muhammad's son-in-law, and they hit themselves over the head with rocks. You never see them? They're bleeding down their heads. Right? So they do that. They do things like that in Yom Kippur. The mamash, they whip each other. They stand until they physically drop. They don't sleep all night. They mamash stand in the heat. They stand. They sit on sharp objects. I mean, it really look crazy because they want to actively afflict themselves because that's what the Torah says I should do. They don't have an oral tradition. It's of course chaotic because your affliction is different than my affliction, right? But that's what they do. So you know, I'd say this goes back beyond the Dead Sea Scroll sects, which are about 2,200 years ago, because Yeshayahu, in the Haftorah of Yom Kippur, it's all in these sources, there's just so much to do in a short amount of time, Yeshayahu, in the Haftorah of Yom Kippur, says, why are you beating yourselves? Why are you sitting in sackcloth? Why are you berating yourselves and harming yourselves on this holy day? That's not what I expect of you. What I expect of you, halozet tzom, they are fasting, pros l'ra'ev lachmecha, feed the poor with what you feel hungry now? Good, use that hunger, because there are some people who always feel that way. So share the food after Yom Kippur with someone who's always hungry. They're hungry tomorrow night that way too. Right? So Yeshayahu is berating the people for behaving the way the Karaites write, you should behave on Yom Kippur. How do I know it's Yom Kippur? It's so perfectly the Haftorah of Yom Kippur, because he talks about why aren't you freeing the slaves? That's the Yom Kippur issue, right? Yovel. It's probably a Yovel that he delivered this speech, right? And he talks throughout the Haftorah, it's chapter 58 and 59 of the book of Isaiah, he talks about the fast that I expect of you. And I don't want you with any self-flagellation. That's not what I expect of his fast. He had to berate the people from doing what is the plain sense of the verse in the Torah. So the Talmud teaches us that the observance of Be'nisim Nafshu Seichem is done b'shev al taseh, by doing nothing. Just sit down and do nothing. And you observe Yom Kippur. You know, refrain from things. Refrain from labor. Refrain from eating and drinking. So what does this have to do with Nedarim? Don't you get it now? What did the Mishnah say about Nedarim? Hataras Nedarim. By starting Yom Kippur with Kol Nidre, we are showing that we are subservient, or we are dependent, or we submit to the oral tradition of Haftaras Nedarim. You get it? Now, the true, that could have been done with any other rabbinic, not shouldn't say rabbinic, oral tradition observance, right? We could prepare our pre-Eitz Hadar and say, and walk around the shul on right as Yom Kippur is starting and say, Bona Shalom, we're taking this fruit in 4 days, in 5 days, and we wouldn't know what this fruit is if not for the fact that we submit to your oral tradition of what a pre-Eitz Hadar is. Right? But so the Mishnah in the Seches Chagiga says the epitome of Torah Shebaal Peh is Hataras Nedarim. So it stands on its own that of all things to start Yom Kippur with, it should be something that's the absolute submission of the Torah does not speak to us if not from an oral tradition. How do I know this? Because the Torah itself expects us to have an oral tradition that God shared with Moses, that to explain clearly the Torah is incomprehensible in many places without an oral tradition. Right? What is malacha on Shabbos that I should avoid? Right? What is this? So what do I do on Rosh Hashanah with this shofar? Right? That I only determine through a rabbinic tradition at all. So this proof of that, you know, God tells Moshe sometimes, do this the way I told you, and that is not written anywhere else in the Torah. So of course God told Moshe things that define other things written in the Torah, and that's the oral tradition that we're keeping. But I would like to make another specific reason why the Dharam is chosen to anything else. Because it is a it gives us a great example of what tshuva can accomplish, of what repentance accomplishes. When Yeshayahu was speaking to his audience, the people, and I mentioned this last night in my Shabbat Shuvah drasha, is that the people were largely fatalistic. Remember the people's response when Yeshayahu was told to go to the potter's wheel, and then so they said, no wash means we're hopeless. We can't change our destiny. We're hopelessly locked into this destiny with my health, with my family, with my children, whatever it may be. And I can't change that, so why bother listening to this guy? So Yeshua says that nothing could be further from the truth. You always get a start over, a do-over every single day. You can fly away by plane for 24 hours and return on foot in 5 minutes. It's always a return. So this is an interesting, I'm going to say this from halacha, and accept it, to try to get the point I'm making. It's a gemara in Ksuvos. Of why we want to start Yom Kippur with Kol Nidre. Gemara says that if a man wants to betroth a woman, he gives her a ring, right? Okay, this is my wife.
I gave her a ring,
and I said, "Hareyat mekudeshesli, you are betrothed to me," and we can make a condition. At the time of the Talmud, people didn't court for too long. So they didn't know so much about each other. So they built conditions into the marriage.
Absolutely.
And if this condition didn't come to fruition, the marriage is dissolved, even without a divorce. Right? Even if it was shown, usually it was shown to come true weeks or months later. But if it's shown to come true years later, we'll dissolve the marriage. And this is used in some places today, in the right way. Okay, to save avunas. So let's give this example. I say, that I have no outstanding nedarim. While we were courting, she said, I really don't want to be married to someone who makes oaths and vows. And I want to be married to someone who's free to do everything, enjoy life. I don't want to be married to someone who says, I won't eat meat, I won't drink wine. If a man's a noser, you should fess up and tell his betrothed, what's going on, what kind of life you can expect with me. Is it going to be a total asceticism, or is it going to be to enjoy the good things that God has for us here? So, from off to the middle, and it'll get some little wind blow. So if he says to her, you are betrothed to me on the condition that I have no outstanding vows, right? Or another example is, the Gemara says, and it could be either way. It could be that you have no vows, or I have no vows, doesn't matter. But, or if he says, you are betrothed to me on the condition that I have no defects. I'm perfectly healthy. Right? Okay, so the two of them. Right? So, after they get married, they find out that he's been taking chemotherapy. What's crazy? What do you lie to her? Right? But then what happens? The doctor treats him. He's fully cured, and he's totally... He goes 5 years, he goes a long time. Whatever it may be. It could be...
Remission.
It's remission. Whatever, I don't know if that's the best example. He says, the Gemara says you could do any condition. She says, I don't want to be married to someone who has warts. He goes, okay, I have no warts, whatever. Right? So this happens to be one of the examples that Gemara gives. So then they find out that he has that medical issue, but then a doctor totally clears him of that issue. He's freed from it. It's no more. It doesn't exist anymore, and it's not coming back. So what do you think? Should that be married or not? Should they stay married? After all, from now that you found out that I have that condition, but I don't have it anymore.
He lied.
But he still lied at the time of the wedding, right? The time he gave her the ring. So what do you think?
I think there's a trust problem in the relationship.
Okay, all right. But let's... yes, okay. There's certainly a trust issue when it comes to
I don't think the marriage is called at all, because it was amanat that I don't have this. Great, I'm cured now, but at some point...
So now listen to an amazing chiddush. You're right, the marriage is dissolved. Because he lied, and he was sick at the time he gave her the ring. Or he had warts or whatever else the condition was. But here's an amazing halacha. If he says to her, you are betrothed to me on the condition that I have no outstanding vows. And at the time of the Gemara, this was a big thing. People used to make vows off of the cup. And that's what we have. We're learning with Daf Yomi now, Nidarim and Nazir, and people used to ruin the next month of their relationship because of a stupid word.
Is that itself a vow?
that I have no vows? Is that itself a vow?
It comes as your word. You know, your word should be a vow. Needs a certain type of declaration. Be that as it may, if he says you are betrothed to me on the condition that I have no vows, and then they get married, and he says, listen, I'm sorry, I was worried what you would think if I had these vows, but I'll tell you what, I'm going to go to a chacham, I'm going to go to a beis din, and I have a vow not to eat meat, I have a vow not to drink wine, I have a vow not to go to the movies, I have a vow to, and I know you that. When we were recording, you said you like those things and you want to share those things with me, so I'm going to go to a beis din, and I'm going to ask them absolution for these things, and the beis din hears it, they explain why it's important, he wants to stay married to her, but, and they give him hataras nedarim, married or not.
No.
So, okay, what do you think?
He
lied to her again, didn't he? He lied there too. It's a matter of trust, isn't it?
But there's something special about
his parents. Yes, as Ellen already knows, is that there's something special about a Taurus Nadarim that's different than all other such examples. Is that the doctor cures him, he's well. Fine, he's however the Gemara knows, he's never coming back. So what does she care? But sorry, then do it again. But yes, the condition didn't count. If they want to be married, he has to give her another ring. She gets to keep the original ring, by the way. He has to give her another ring, and they have to do it again.
A Taurus Nadarim is retroactive. It means he never made it.
A Taurus Nadarim is retroactive. When they do a Taurus Nadarim, it's as if though, that's why we say all those Lashonas, Lo Shririn, Lo Kayomin, Mutola, and we say all those Lashonas in a Taurus Nadarim, because it is as if though it retroactively uproots it. Well, that's why we want to start Yom Kippur with this, because that's what Tshuva does.
Well, what would it be if you say, as long as I never end up in jail, and then guy end, I just with it, a daughter-in-law was passing phony checks and ended up in jail for a year.
Are you talking about a real case?
Yes.
Okay. That's cool. So this is a big chiddush, because the Gemara at the end of Maseches Yuma says that the if you do tshuva, it not only does it wipe out the Avera, right? It turns it around to a mitzvah. It's crazy. How does that work? The Gemara says that if a person ate pork all year, Erev Yom Kippur, the person really regrets the pork, right? So the Gemara says it's a difference with how the tshuva started. If the tshuva started from yira, from being afraid, I'm afraid, so, all right, it just wipes it clean. But if the tshuva is, yira means that I'm afraid of the punishment because of all the pork I ate. I'm seeing things in a different way, and I feel bad about all that pork, so I'm worried what God is going to do to me this year. But if the tshuva comes from, not a fear, but I want to get close to God, what made me eat all that pork is just, I don't know. I was just drawn in, and I didn't do it lahachis. Well, even if I did, but I was weak. Let's say, you know what? Let's make it more interesting. All the lashon hara I spoke this past because nobody's free from lashon hara, right? Everybody speaks lashon hara.
You have to ask forgiveness of the people.
So yeah. You do have to. You don't have to be specific with them, because if it's going to make things worse, then you go to someone and say, you know that job you lost back in February, it was because of me. Forgive me. It's going to hit them over the head. Remember that woman you wanted to date who turned you down. I'm sorry. It was because of me. So if you'd say something that's going to make it worse, then don't do that.
Armin used to say, I never say Lashon Hara, but if you want to know things about people who do, just
Okay, so whatever it is. Because pork, who knows? Do you know anyone who eats pork? No. But Lashon Hara, everybody speaks. It's a Gemara. It's a Gemara by the end of Bava Basra. Everybody speaks Lashon Hara. Gemara says, you know, avak Lashon Hara, whatever it is. But I don't mean to speak speaking Lashon Hara about that, but it's a Gemara. What can I say? All right, so you go. what Ataras Nadarim does is really what Tshuva does. It uproots the thing from retroactively, and in some instances, if it's a Tshuva because I feel so, how can I be doing that? Why was I speaking that way? I must have been temporary insanity when I said those things. But here I said it, right? So I did it, or I ate it, whatever it is. So now on Erev Yom Kippur, I'm really there to do the real tshuva. I may be here next year doing the same things, right? Yeah. Reviewing the same things I did during the year, but I really mean it now, right? So not only does it become, the pork is wiped clean, the pork becomes like matzah on Pesach, the Gemara says. It becomes like a mitzvah. Zechut,
mech,
zdonos, nasek, zechuyos. Right, you get it? And what you did b'meis, it becomes like a zechus. So that's a huge chiddush, isn't it? So I just gave you two reasons why Kol Nidre is worthy to start Yom Kippur. One, for a general thing, because it's an oral tradition. The mahut, the nature of the day, is very much dependent on an oral tradition of how to behave today. I don't have to actively go out and find something to do to afflict myself. So all this is a Gemara at the end of Maseches Yom. There's a little lumdus in this, if I can just digress for 3 minutes for lumdus. The first Mishnah in Maseches Krisus mentions two positive commandments that have punishments. Only two. In other words, if I don't wear tefillin, if I don't wear tzitzis, if I don't eat matzah, no punishment. I just violated a chance to get a mitzvah. Punishments are for negative commands. I stole, right? So, but there are two exceptions. What are the two exceptions?
Exceptions to what?
That if I don't do a positive commandment, there's a punishment. Punishment of curries. If I don't give a bris to my son.
Like Moshe.
Or if I don't have a circumcision myself, or if I don't eat the carbon Pesach on Pesach.
Wow.
Okay, those two. And they're intertwined a little bit, but okay. So the Rambam asks in the Perusha Mishnah to the beginning of Maseches Krisus, wait, there's a third one. It says in the Torah, afflict yourselves on Yom Kippur. It's a positive command, right? Mm-hmm. And if you don't afflict yourselves on Yom Kippur, it says you have curries. You have a punishment. The Rambam counts affliction on Yom Kippur as a positive commandment. And if you don't do this positive commandment, you're punished. So now, based on what I just said, explain what the Rambam says, why doesn't the Mishnah in Krisus list three positive commandments that carry punishment? You don't give yourself a bris, you don't bring the Pesach sacrifice on the day before Passover, and you don't afflict yourselves in Yom Kippur. The Rambam says what's clear to us. The Mishnah only lists two.
The third one is subject to the oral law.
Okay. We didn't know what they meant.
The others are very specific.
Let me tell you, circumcision is also very subject to oral laws. Yes. I wouldn't know how to do it if I didn't have an oral law.
Okay.
It's a positive.
I'm sorry,
what? They don't look at it as a mitzvah say.
Right. It is a mitzvah sasei, but it doesn't behave like a mitzvah sasei. Right? How do I violate a mitzvah sasei? How do I violate tzitzis, tefillin, lulav and esrog?
By just not doing it.
By not doing something. Sitting down and not putting on the tzitzis.
I'm not eating. I'm refraining from doing something.
This mitzvah sasei doesn't behave like a mitzvah. How do I violate a negative commandment? By doing something. By wearing the chatnis. By eating the treif. By speaking the Lashon Hara. So this positive commandment is different than all other positive commandments in the Torah. It behaves like a negative commandment. How do I keep it?
By doing it.
By doing nothing. How do I violate it? By doing something. So since it behaves like a negative commandment, it wasn't listed in the Mishnah. Okay? So good. So all of this is now... Now, so turn to page 15.
Is it appropriate to talk about when was Tshuva created?
It's interesting because the Gemara talks about it, that it's part of
Adam
HaRishon.
Before the world.
Yes.
Seven things.
Gemara in Psachim says all the things that were created before
the world. Knew what we was what.
So that Adam HaRishon has an opportunity. Cain has an opportunity. All right. So I'm going to shut.
Okay. Oh, it's the fish that ate Jonah, the thing that cuts the stones for the Beit HaMikdash. I could ask my wife for the other four or five. Wow. Unbelievable.
So look at all the different words that we have at the top of page 15. I just wanted to translate Kol Nidre, and then we'll call it a day. Right? Now, historically speaking, there are a number of Rishonim who make no reference whatsoever to Kol Nidre. It's a very strong question. Who wrote it? Where does it come from? Why do some communities say it? Some Sephardim have it, yes.
It's different wording.
Yeah. So it appears as early as Rav Sadia Gaon, which means 9th century. It appears in the Zohar, which now you're up to scholarship. The Zohar written, right? The Zohar, according to its readers and adherents, and its, you know, the Arizal and those who like to study it, was written by Shimon bar Yochai. Because the opening line in the Zohar is Amar Rav Shimon bar Yochai. Right? Right? The opening line in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer is Amar Rabbi Eliezer. Okay? So the opening line in Medrash Tanchuma is Amar Rabbi Tanchuma. So, you know, you can figure it out. However, even though proponents of saying that Shimon bar Yochai wrote it agree that it wasn't revealed to the world until the time of Rav Moshe Cordovero. Late 13th, 14th centuries. Right? So, and his wife at his funeral said, my husband wrote it and attributed to Rav Shimon bar Yochai, some more people will use it. I'm just putting out there what's said in the scholarly circles. The Zohar makes reference to Kol Nidre. I'm just putting it out there, okay? On source number 18 at the bottom there Okay. That being said, there is a Gemara in Maseches Nedarim, that's source number 14 at the top of this page on the right side, that says, Harotzeh shelo yiskaimu nedarav kol hashana yamod b'rosh hashana v'yomar kol neder sha'ani osid lidor yehi batil. Alright? If you want to make sure that you don't make foolish Nedarim the coming year, on Rosh Hashanah, we do it every Rosh Hashanah. Just say, whatever neder I make this year, if I don't, you know, if I don't, he has to remember that he said that. But I just ran off my mouth with my wife. Oh, what made me say that? Oh yeah, but I still have Rosh Hashanah. It doesn't count, so I have to get it mulligan. All right. So that's already in the Gemara. But the whole expression here, Kol Nidre, V'Sarei, V'Chonamei, this whole thing, it appears in the Zohar the first time. So I guess it depends on: do you hold that it's written by Shimon bar Yochai, in which case it's very antique, right? Or is it sometime later, in which case it may be that the source number 16 is the earliest historical reference that's about the 9th century, getting into the 10th century. Okay? All right, it's very close to our Jake, does the Sadia Gaon look a little closer to what you guys are saying? Right? So, and it's in, you know, the difference whether it should be in Aramaic or in Hebrew. We say it in Aramaic. Mm-hmm. Right? Some Sephardim say it in Hebrew. Okay. Do you know? Can you read it? It's all Aramaic, right? And all of a sudden, it moves into Hebrew. Miyom Kippurim Zeh, right? Kiyom Kippurim Abba, then it goes back to Aramaic. What's going on here? Right. So I'll tell you this: is that there have been great opposition to saying Kol Nidre in a number of Jewish communities. One is because it's quite nebulous whether it's talking about what I made from last year to this year, or what I'm making from this year to next year. Mm. Which one is it? Right? So some say both. I'm covering last year, and I'm covering this year. What's much worse than this is that this came to great opposition. So there were opposition in Christian communities as early as the 8th century from their sources. The problem is that I don't have books that have Kol Nidre in it from as early as I have record of Christian objections to it.
Yeah, they probably burned them.
It must have existed, right? We don't have Siddurim then. We didn't have airtight rooms to hold on to Siddurim if they existed even from the 8th century or Jewish sources that do. Jews generally didn't daven from Siddurim all year, but they did on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Right? So, even then, a lot of communities just said everything out loud and people just listened because they didn't have Siddurim. Why did Christians object to our Kol Nidre? Yes?
My grandmother used to say when she was young, the women couldn't read Hebrew. They had one woman who was called a reader, yeah, who used to stay with groups of women, wow, and they had a lot of the readers around in the schools.
Great. Okay, what was Christian objection to this? Not to mention from a number of Jewish objections.
Eliminate debt?
Yes, what are you talking about? You made a promise to me in business that you're going to deliver me these goods, and now Kol Nidre comes in between, and now you're free from that? Who wants to do business with Jews? Right? And the Jews behave this way, one to the other, that they're just absolving themselves of all their. Look at these Lashonos, the Sarei, Shvuei, Karmei. These are all different, all kinds of obligations you place upon yourself. From last year to this year to next year, who's Lo Shvikin, Lo Shvisin, they don't apply, they're nonsense. Everything I started off before. Who's going to keep commitments with Jews? Right? So, okay, that, I must tell you, was already resolved by those who said that, no, this is only talking about commitments I take
personally
on myself. I committed that I'm going to learn 400 blot Gemara this year, and it's almost the end of the year, and I see I've only learned 210 blot. How am I going to learn 190 blot? No, I'm going to go to a Beis Din, and I'm going to say, you know, I really thought I'd be able to make it. Something happened. I got this distraction. Will you absolve me of this vow? They don't automatically do it, by the way, but they have to hear, how much they tried, because they really don't want you to take these things lightly, right? If your word is not your bond, then that's bad not only for Jews, it's bad for the Torah, it's bad for the community.
So how do we do an appeal on the Kol Nidre?
Isn't that funny? Right after Kol Nidre, you say, "Well, it's all."
How do you become such a customer?
Believe that.
So I've asked that question at Kol Nidre, and I said, "So here's the answer." All this is in these sources, but it's too much, and I have to stop soon. Let's just finish with a little. I'll look up these two sources. It's on page. It's sources 4 through 13. It's like the second page. Right after the, right behind the. Right. So Torah says, "When you make a neder, keep it right away." Right. Okay. Keep all your promises. Keep your words. Right. And then Koheles, source number 5 and 5a, says, "Be careful with the obligations you place upon yourself." Look at verse 4. Better that you do not vow at all than you vow and not pay. Okay, good Shabbos, of course.
Can you make a neder on force or just on actions?
No, I have to express it. No, it has to. You have to express it. Oh, you can make a neder. Oh, maybe I won't think. No, can't control that. So the Koheles Rabbah in the Gemara Nedarim, so 6, 7, 8, right, says that it's not only better not to make a vow than to make it and keep and not keep it. That's obvious. It's better not to make a vow than to make it and keep it. Don't make vows. Right? You shouldn't be making vows. How do you take it? So you say Bli Neder. So what are we doing that on Yom Kippur? Why are we making a mechshol for all these people on Yom Kippur? A stumbling block for people that are saying I'm going to give $1,000.
So it says tshuva.
Because tshuva tefillah tzedakah matzah. Right. Because exactly, because these sources are here. Because there is a cloud when it comes to stuff. Amazing cloud. Gemara says, and by the way, this is the law in the United States. Amira l'gvoa ki mesira l'hedyot. Whatever means the law of the United States. If you publicly, people heard you say, I'm giving $1,000 to this school.
You're more likely to actually give it.
Not only more likely to give it, the school has a lien on it. That person, nope. Yes, if people heard, you get your witnesses to testify that this person publicly said, and they made a public appeal, that the pledge becomes actionable.
It's like an electronic signature.
They can take you to court on it.
Wow.
You might have to have, a case or something, but they have to build a case. But if someone, there's been many times, that people go after this, and wills, and other things like that. So when a person says, on Yom Kippur Eve, I gave $1,000, I'm giving another $1,000, whatever it is, that is as if though it is given. Of course, the person has to ultimately give it. How much time do they have? That's a machlokas in the Gemara. They might have till the next Sukkot to give it. But it counts. No, they have to have three holidays. If Sukkot, Shemini Atzeres might count as another one, and then Pesach. So they have till Pesach to give it. Or they might have till the next Shavuos to give it, according to the one that says Shemini Atzeres is like Sukkot. But they have time to do it, and it, but it gets the person gets credit already for it on Yom Kippur. In other words, when God, okay, let me see how much tzedakah that person gave. Oh, you said on your kippah, he's giving another thousand. Okay, I'll put that in there.
What about a non-monetary vow?
So, that might be different. Only a mira l'gvoa k'misira l'hedyot. So how much does that get in? If I make a vow, I'm going to learn 200 pages of the Talmud. Does the person get... I don't think so. It's a great question. We're going to have to see if it covers that. Because there's a mira l'gvoa. I mean, mira, whatever you say. I think it's limited to charity. Because charity is a special din. All over, we see charity being treated differently. To get you. Okay, okay. All right, so that's what. So what we're saying is that the Gemara in the Seches Chulin says that how can Rabbi Meir say that better to not vow than to vow and keep it? We don't see that Yaakov, when he makes a vow in Parshas Vayetze, it says Vayidar Yaakov Nedur Lemor. Rabbis don't look down on that. Right? Rabbi Meir should say, Yaakov, you sinned in making that vow. Why don't they say it? Because he didn't sin in making that vow. Why not? Because the Gemara says Yaakov was in trouble. Yaakov was, when you're in a foxhole, you may make some promises that, you know, right? So that's the answer we say in Yom Kippur. Who is the person, who is the one in need? Not the recipient of your charity. That person, we'll take care of that person. You're in need. You're in need. God doesn't need your money. You're in need. You need more tzedakah. So just say, I'm giving this money, and as soon as you say it, you have to express it. That's why we make a public appeal. So express it is as if though that money is given. You should say this every time before the appeal, but then people get tired of it. They used to say it every year.
You know what the Kovitz Chaim said about this?
Yeah.
Said a despicable custom arose in the United States where they make these appeals. It is a breeding ground for Lashon Hara. One guy said, I'll give $3 million. With all his money, that's all he gives? Or, with the trouble he has in his family, he could hardly pay the bills?
Anyway, so so they say because Yaakov was able to make the neder because he was in need. So we're in need of Kol Nidre. Alright, I think in a nutshell, I may be able to close with that, is that the real connection is to the nature of the day of Yom Kippur. So when the Mishnah of Maseches Tainis says that the two happiest days on the Jewish calendar are Tu B'Av, because of Shiduchim, and you meet your betrothed, and Yom Kippur. So Gemara says, Tu B'Av, we understand. There's a lot of dancing, there's a singing.
Yom HaKippur.
But what makes Yom Kippur said to be such a festival? So the Gemara says...
Daylight Purim.
That you can make a drash, but the Gemara, the Mishnah says, because it's the day, the Gemara says, it's the day that the oral tradition was given to Israel. You get it? Because Moshe spent all that time at Mount Sinai praying on behalf of Israel to be forgiven for the golden calf. He was learning how to build the Mishkan, and he was receiving the divine traditions of how to explain these nebulous portions of Torah. The Ksava Kabbalah discusses in his introduction, why didn't God just reveal the written law, the oral law also? No, that is no end to that. That's a never-ending flow. The written law is fixed. The oral tradition and how the mafalpel, how to make a chiddush, how every generation has to build on the chiddushim, the newer approaches from the previous generations, and this is mafalpel b'Torah. This is an obligation of every generation. The Tzib makes a big deal about this, especially at the end of his parish to the Torah, so that the as if though the revelation is ongoing, and that the Torah is kept alive. It's not stunted. So this is what the Gemara means, is that because the oral tradition was revealed on Yom Kippur, it gives us the joy of the holiday. Yom Kippur is supposed to be a festive day, just without food.
Unless you have diabetes.
That's a problem. All right, but that's some of the context of
amazing.